From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And let's get right to the reporting today that warnings were sent to President Trump and his inner circle early on about the possibility of a COVID-19 pandemic. It's not known if Trump saw the memos, but others who said they did say they didn't believe the messenger. That would be White House economic advisor Peter Navarro. We've occasionally heard from him in task force briefings. He's a well-known China hawk who had an eye on the outbreak there. Both the New York Times and Axios are reporting he sent the first note to the National Security Council at the end of January, calling for an immediate ban on travel from China after the virus exploded there. The other memo, 1 month later, was written to the president himself. It was headlined, "There's an increasing probability of a full-blown COVID-19 pandemic that could infect as many as 100 million Americans with a loss of life of as many as 1 to 2 million souls." A day after Navarro wrote that, President Trump tweeted the coronavirus was very much under control and the stock market was looking good. Margaret Talev broke this story for Axios, where she's White House and politics editor. And Margaret, we know the president is now saying he felt it was a pandemic long before it was called a pandemic, but he didn't acknowledge the possible number of deaths until very recently. What are your sources saying? Is it conceivable that such a warning in February would be withheld from the president?
Yeah, I mean, these are all the questions that we want to get to the heart of. And thanks for the opportunity to talk about this story. These two memos are extraordinary in their detail, not just Peter Navarro's estimates, but some of his recommendations in the subsequent memo in late February, not just for the sort of money and stimulus funding that seemed like shockingly high numbers at the time, but in addition to that, the idea of the sort of specificity for personal protective equipment requests that he was suggesting for healthcare workers, for secondary workers, 1 billion face masks, 200,000 Tyvek suits, 11,000 ventilator circuits, so on and so forth. These very detailed recommendations, and he made clear that these are scenarios based on modeling that it could end up being nothing, being something akin to a flu, and that if it was, it would cost several billions worth of dollars, but that if it wasn't, if it was a pandemic, the cost would be in the trillions and the loss of lives would be astronomical.
And Margaret, we're going to be looking at this all day, of course, but tell us more about the response back then.
Well, what we know about the response is that we didn't even know about the details of these memos until yesterday. And so the way it was received inside the White House, and our understanding is that this went to several officials internally but was not discussed externally, was that there were very many advisors to the president who just sort of thought, well, it's Peter Navarro, like he wants a ban on, you know, travel from China, or he wants to be tough on China vis-a-vis his ongoing role in the trade talks, and that there just were many people who did not take his concerns seriously, or thought in balance the likelihood of them happening against the massive economic fallout was, you know, too unlikely to proceed in that sort of alarmist pace. But we also think there were many inside the White House who were concerned about this, including some inside the National Security Council. And I expect that's where you're going to see this conversation go in the coming days. By the way, the president himself really sent mixed signals. On the one hand, he seemed to be taking some of Peter Navarro's pushes seriously. He did proceed with that China travel ban. He did proceed with something, sort of these quarantines, but nothing publicly.
Yeah, and not the death toll, certainly. Margaret Talev, White House and politics editor for Axios. As we said, we'll keep looking at this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Michigan, which has more confirmed cases than any state except New York and New Jersey. More than 600 people have died in the Metro Detroit area alone. And joining us now is Sterling Heights Mayor Michael Taylor. His city is about 25 miles north of Detroit. Welcome, Mayor.
Thank you, Tanya.
So as I mentioned, Detroit, the metro area of Detroit has seen a surge in cases. How has your city fared?
Well, we're over 300 confirmed cases, and we don't know exactly how many deaths, but we know that there are many families grieving loved ones right now. It's really incomprehensible. Just 2 or 3 weeks ago, we never thought it would impact us the way it did, and it continues to grow, and we continue to fight this every day, every hour.
I want to also ask you about the economic impact. Your city has a lot of residents who work in service jobs and a lot who have these really good jobs in manufacturing at those auto plants. Are they all out of work right now?
The economy is pretty much ground down to a halt. You know, the service industry has been decimated, the manufacturing industry. And so we have four major automotive plants, two Ford and two Chrysler plants, and they're all shut down. So this is a devastating impact that we're going to feel for quite some time. But I've seen the community really come together, and I'm proud of the way that we've addressed this. We're all taking the order to stay home seriously, and we're all helping each other out, whether it's making masks or making food or cutting the grass for a neighbor. We're doing everything that we can to get through this. And so I'm confident that when we get out of it, we'll be able to rebound, because things were going really great here in Sterling Heights and in Metro Detroit. So it's such a shame to see so many families struggling financially, but the health impact has to be dealt with first.
I want to talk with you about political solutions. So you were a lifelong Republican and a 2016 Trump supporter and voter. But a month ago, you said you were planning to vote for former Vice President Joe Biden. You say that his values align really closely with yours. I'm just wondering, as a Republican and a Biden supporter, you have a sort of interesting political position, and you've been watching people, as you say, lose their jobs and therefore their health care in the middle of this pandemic. What do you see as the political solution?
What I do think is that it has to start at the top. And one of the problems that I've seen is that there's really a hodgepodge of solutions from city to city, from state to state. And I would like to see the federal government provide some sort of guidance about how this can be addressed on a nationwide basis. And I think people are hungry for that sort of a resolution. While the doctors and the scientists work on a cure, a vaccine, and a strategy to keep us safe, our politicians should be looking forward to how do we rebuild out of this. I am going to support Joe Biden this November. I voted for him in the Michigan primary, and I think that his leadership is steady, calm leadership is what the country needs coming out of this.
That's Sterling Heights Mayor Michael Taylor. Mayor Taylor, thank you so much for taking the time, and you stay safe. Thank you for this update.
You too, Tanya. Thank you.
Well, let's check in now on Singapore, the city island nation of 6 million, which early on won praise for strategies that contain the coronavirus without a full lockdown. Now it's facing a second wave, and it's implementing new restrictions. The BBC's Saranjeet Lail joins us now on Skype from Singapore. And Saranjeet, remind us what Singapore did early on, tracking down every infection.
That's right. I mean, Singapore had really relied on contact tracing. That's what they called it. That's a way of tracking down people who came into the city. As soon as they arrived, you know, they'd get temperature screened at the airport. If anybody showed any high temperatures, fevers, they'd be taken aside, they'd be swabbed. So it was a really good method to begin with. But there was more recently, in recent weeks, a rise in unlinked cases of lots more local infections. And that's now required much tougher social distancing measures. So, right. I mean, can you believe that with nearly half of the world's population in some sort of lockdown, Singapore, which is one of the earliest places outside China to see infected cases in late January, is also, ironically, one of the last places to actually impose right. stay-at-home guidelines, which only have taken effect today.
Well, that's so interesting, because the tracing was working, so they didn't have to do this. I mean, they had some social distancing. We understand the restaurants were open, but people didn't sit close together. Now we understand that the city-state is imposing 4 weeks of what? Complete lockdown?
That's right. So essentially most workplaces, except for essential services, key economic sectors, they're closed starting today until May the 4th. Students of local schools will move to full home-based learning from Wednesday.
This is such a cautionary tale about a state that did everything right and had control of it. And now this second wave, how are people there reacting?
The tracking is very sophisticated. I mean, Singapore was one of the first places to launch something on your mobile phone that you could download, and it was called Trace Together. And it would track your every movement. Yes, you did give up your privacy to some degree, but most people here tend to think, well, that's okay because it's for the larger good.
Well, also, it is a very small, maybe easier to track population, but also it's a very small, easier to decimate population, everybody gathered in one space.
That's right.
If they don't do things, and yes, we have heard about the cell phone tracking so that the government knows if you actually are quarantining. Some people would balk at that, but as you say, not in Singapore.
I mean, there's been some very worrying cases. I should add that the government just this weekend has isolated two very large dormitories full of the city's population of migrant, mainly construction workers, because there was a huge spike of infections amongst their population. So essentially, this has put some 20,000 of these workers in quarantine. But a number of these workers have told the media that they're afraid. They're saying they're really scared they may catch it too.
The BBC's Sharanjit Lail in Singapore. Sharanjit, thank you and stay safe.
You too, Robin.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
And almost every day, President Trump has been holding COVID-19 task force briefings at the White House. It got us thinking about how other administrations have handled national crises in the past. One of them, maybe the biggest, was World War II, which was coming to an end around this time 75 years ago. Germany surrendered in May of 1945. Japan's surrender would follow. The U.S. entered the war 4 years after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and President Franklin Roosevelt delivered this famous speech where he asked Congress to declare war.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Let's bring in Julian Zelizer. He is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And Julian, let's start with the present. There's so much we don't know, including how and when this crisis will end. But as an historian watching it right now, what are you thinking about?
Well, I think about three things. One, I obviously think about the enormous human and economic cost that this brings to our society in 2020, mm-hmm. like many other citizens are thinking about. Second, I'm really thinking about how will this transform us as a nation? How will it change our public health system? What kinds of changes will it bring to the economy? And third, I'm thinking about why were we so unprepared? A little bit like after 9/11, when we looked back and saw the pieces were there, why were we not in better shape for a pandemic when people have been warning, including in the White House, that a pandemic could be devastating?
Yeah, I want to talk to you a little bit more about 9/11 and those preparations. We'll get to those in just a moment. But we heard President Roosevelt back then in 1941. He led the nation to victory in World War II, although he did not live to actually see that. How did he rise to meet that crisis and that he and really the country faced at that time?
Well, part of FDR's success was always his words. He spoke with great clarity and he spoke with great gravitas. And as the situation in Europe and with Japan got worse, he would literally explain to the public through fireside chats, through addresses to Congress, what was going on, what the stakes were, and what needed to be done. He also was not scared to mobilize the full power of government once the war began, not only to fight overseas, but here to produce the munitions we needed and to make sure the economy was stable. And I think both of those were the reasons ultimately he was so successful.
Yeah, Vice President Harry Truman assumed the presidency after FDR died, and he had to make that decision to drop atomic bombs on Japan to force them to surrender. You mentioned 9/11, which I want to get to, but are there things that we could learn today from the national leadership then at that difficult time?
Well, that's the, you know, biggest controversial element of his presidency that we still debate today. And it really shows the enormity of what can happen because of a presidential decision. Sometimes presidents are treated as these abstract people and the White House is an institution that's so grave. But that decision shows that, you know, one word from the president can lead to enormous human loss. And that is something every president should carry on their shoulders as they're in the Oval Office.
You know, U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams recently called what's going on now our Pearl Harbor moment, our 9/11 moment. What can you tell us about American leadership? A lot of us were alive and were adults during that time, during 9/11 and the leadership during that time.
Well, part of it is it wasn't exactly Pearl Harbor in that certainly with 9/11, as we looked back, there was a lot of evidence this was a threat and that we were vulnerable in the ways that become apparent on 9/11. And part of the lesson was we didn't do enough when people were warning something had to happen and we waited for the crisis to unfold. But after the terrorist attack happens, at least on counterterrorism, the administration did move very aggressively, and it remade our institutions and policies in real time to try to create some sort of normalcy. And I think that was an important lesson. And there's also an important mistake. The president often, President Bush, pursued issues that weren't directly related to the 9/11 attacks, such as the war in Iraq, that ultimately undercut some of our success to deal with what had happened.
You know, this is not a war in the traditional sense. This is a very different crisis. Do you feel that it calls for a special or different kind of leadership that we've not seen before?
Well, some of it is traditional. It is. It's a war against a disease. It's not a war against another state or against a terrorist network. But some of the traditional tactics are needed. We do need a president who can speak clearly to the public. We do need a president who is willing and capable of mobilizing the resources that government can provide in times like these to save us and to help restore some kind of normalcy. But I do think this, even more than war, requires the elevation of expertise. And this is going to be essential that the president respects scientific expertise and gives it the public platform because it's a public health epidemic. And that's a little different than the wars we've been talking about.
Yeah, you know, we really can't ignore that this is happening during an election year. So there's so much that we will be watching for. Only time will tell, really, what will happen in November. That's Julian Zelizer. He is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, as always, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, now we want to hear about what's being called the first known instance of person-to-animal transmission of COVID-19. On Sunday, the Bronx Zoo announced 4-year-old Malayan tiger Nadia tested positive for the virus, most likely catching it from an unwitting, unknown employee who had no symptoms and probably still doesn't. And 3 other tigers and 3 lions are showing the same symptoms as Nadia. Dr. Paul Kelly is chief veterinarian at the Bronx Zoo. Dr. Kelly, first, how is Nadia?
Nadia and her sister Azul and all the other ill tigers and lions are all doing very well. All of them had a dry cough, and some of them also had wheezing. And Nadia also went off food a little bit of a decrease in appetite. And they seem to be recovering nicely on their own.
Okay, but she's okay. And the employee, are you saying you don't know who Nadia got the infection from?
Correct. And, you know, testing for people in New York City is prioritized based on medical need by the health department.
Right. So since you have nobody sick, no need to test, but take precautions. And I had to smile, Doctor, when I saw that employees at the Bronx Zoo were now social distancing from the tiger. I would stay pretty far away from a tiger anyway, but they're taking more precautions. What do you do now? It's such a contagious disease. Do you plan on testing other animals?
And so the only reason we tested Nadia was because she was sick and not doing well. We actually anesthetized her to perform a health assessment, x-rays, ultrasound, blood work. We tested for a range of feline infectious diseases at the Cornell Veterinary School Laboratory. And because of what's going on in New York City, we, of course, also were concerned about the potential for COVID infection. And so we also collected samples that the veterinary schools at Cornell and the University of Illinois did that testing and then sent the tests on to the USDA's National Veterinary Services Laboratory for confirmatory testing. We've also shared this information both publicly, as I'm doing now, as well as through our scientific peer networks, through the zoos and the zoo veterinarians, so that others can benefit from this and to contribute some information to the scientific knowledge of this virus. And we've had great collaboration and coordination with city, state, and federal public health and animal health agencies, as well as the labs that I mentioned.
And should we be worried about our cats? What are the thoughts as to whether or not we should be, you know, worried about distancing from our own animals?
I think if cats or dogs were really susceptible to this, as the global pandemic has, you know, marched across the globe, there would have been lots of instances of sick cats being reported. So there have been some experimental infections in laboratory settings of very high doses of virus directly put in cats' noses, and they've gotten sick. But there's no instance of any animal actually getting sick with COVID from a person until now. There were a couple reports in dogs and a cat in Hong Kong that they weren't sick and they were in homes of sick people, so they could have just picked up the remnants of the virus in their environment. So it also could have just had virus test positivity.
And since the zoos are closed, we can see them on Animal Planet. Where can we see your animals?
Yeah, coincidentally, the fourth season of Animal Planet show The Zoo about the Bronx Zoo just aired last Saturday. And in conjunction with the fourth series, they're also replaying the first three series. So it's a great opportunity to see the zoo that way. And Azul and Nadia, our tigers, who are now sick with COVID, were featured in one of the earlier episodes when they were cubs. And so you can actually see them as youngsters.
Dr. Paul Kelly, Chief Veterinarian at the Bronx Zoo. Dr. Kelly, thank you.
Thank you very much. It was very nice to speak to you and your listeners.
Okay, put Animal Planet on your stay-at-home viewing list. But also there's a beautiful picture of Nadia at hereandnow.org. Ah, oh, what a creature.
And hospitals across the country have stopped all non-essential procedures to prepare for the flood of coronavirus patients. And that means they're not doing procedures like replacing hips or performing surgery on low-risk cancer patients. We wanted to know more about one critical procedure, kidney transplants. Nearly 100,000 people are awaiting kidney transplants in the U.S. right now. We're joined now by Joseph Vassalotti. He's the chief medical officer of the National Kidney Foundation and a nephrologist at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. And Dr. Vassalotti, are you seeing kidney transplant procedures put on hold across the country?
Well, I think on a national level, I looked at the data and it's interesting there. We do see a drop-off in the living donor transplants. So we're looking at about 1,500 transplants in 2020 versus over 1,700 in 2019, so about 200 less. And that trend began about mid-March. Interestingly, the deceased donor transplants have not dropped off at all. In fact, if anything, there are more deceased donor transplants in 2020, at least up to April 1st. So that's encouraging to see. I would point out that the CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, did come out with an adult elective surgical procedure recommendation, and that does prioritize organ transplantation. And I think it's important that we understand that the deceased donor transplant is obviously a precious issue, having an organ that's available for a finite period of time. Living donation is something that probably will be more challenging to prioritize.
This is a tough question, but it's kind of the elephant in the room because I'm thinking about those living donors because many hospitals are overburdened and the emphasis is on care for coronavirus. We may not see as many of those right now, but with those, with the deceased donors, again, a very tough question, but if someone dies of COVID-19, can you use their kidney in a transplant for someone who needs it?
I don't think so because the virus can clearly be transmitted through the blood. We see there was a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine recently that showed PCR tests can show the viral presence in the blood. So for that reason, I don't think that kidneys from a person infected with COVID-19 or has the COVID-19 disease that they should be candidates for kidney donation.
You know, anyone who has gone through dialysis or has a loved one who is waiting for a kidney transplant, they understand that long and arduous process. What is the cost to an individual patient of postponing a kidney transplant?
Of course, that has to be individualized, but it's, you know, my heart goes out to everyone. I think these are difficult times. But for the individual patient, you have to consider, you know, how can I keep myself healthy for as long as possible if my chances of getting a transplant will be reduced in the short term, hopefully. And then I think the National Kidney Foundation has some programs to help patients find a donor. I think if you're on the deceased donor list, continuing your quest for a living donor is something that we want to encourage people to do. And reaching out to others electronically, reaching out to your friends, certainly that's there's potential to find someone who might be interested in being a living donor.
That's Dr. Joseph Vassalotti, Chief Medical Officer of the National Kidney Foundation and a nephrologist at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
This Palm Sunday, my pastor, Pastor Dan, said, "Well, this has been the Lentiest of Lents, the metaphorical wilderness Christians enter preparing for Easter and the story of Christ's crucifixion and resurrection." And he said it on my computer in an online service. Most houses of worship will be closed this Easter, although about a dozen states, including Florida and Texas, have issued them exemptions to their stay-at-home orders. And Passover starts tomorrow. Now, Jews celebrate at home, but this year there will be no visitors gathered around the Seder table for the retelling of the Israelites' exodus from slavery in ancient Egypt. And by the way, Muslims begin Ramadan April 23rd. Their annual pilgrimage, the Hajj, could be canceled in July. So what to do to find the renewal so many crave? Rabbi Noam Marins is head of interreligious relations at the American Jewish Committee. He joins us from New Jersey. Welcome.
Delight to be here.
And from Arlington, Texas, Pastor Jared Wellman, who leads the Tate Springs Baptist Church there. Pastor Wellman, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And I want to start with you, Pastor, just to clarify. Your governor there in Texas kind of muddied the waters a bit about what people should be doing. He declared all non-essential businesses should close, but then he said religious services are essential. But then his office said, by that we mean you should check with your county. Maybe you could have people drive to a parking lot, stay in their cars, and they would be one parking space apart, and they could be preached to by someone also in their car.
Sure. You know, and I appreciate Governor Abbott. I mean, he's a man of faith. Our thoughts were that there just really wasn't anything else we could really do, unfortunately, when it came to Easter, even if there was a little bit of leeway given.
Yeah, you're going with caution, which most people are. So, Rabbi, to you, Passover in particular, which begins at sundown tomorrow, it's such a moment of gathering family together. What's your first suggestion?
My first suggestion is life and safety above all. And we know that distancing is going to help us defeat this. For the most traditional Jews who might not use electricity, it's particularly challenging. But I think that many Jews are going to connect, whether it's through Zoom or FaceTime or the like.
Gathering people through something like Zoom, which is, you know, it's like building a big Brady Bunch with everybody in your family, their picture pops up. And I'm thinking, too, it's the, you know, people in nursing homes, people who, you know, maybe wouldn't be able to physically come anyway.
We're finding that people are more sensitive than in any other year, and we are making our best attempts to connect with them. I suspect that there will be Orthodox Jews who will make sure to connect before the sun sets and perhaps do some pre-Passover ritual. It might not be at the exact moment of the Seder, but the love can be transmitted in different ways, and I know many people are finding ways to do that.
Pastor Wellman, what are you thinking about for Easter celebration?
We were planning the biggest Easter services that we had probably had in a long time, and we were really excited. We had written specific music. We had our choir prepared to help sing it. But the beauty of what we believe is that it transcends the medium. And so whether it's on campus or online is how we've been providing services. And so now, until further notice, we are an online ministry. So Easter is going to be the same thing. It's just going to be the celebration of the resurrection through online worship.
Well, you know, I've been poking around, and there's so many different suggestions. The suggestions are that if you dress up for Easter, and if there's especially little ones who are going to wear their Easter outfit, put it on, you know, wear it around the house. Or a lot of people are using parades, decorate the cars with balloons and go by a five-year-old's house or a 90-year-old's house in this sort of parade where they all can honk and wave at the house. Do the same thing with sort of a Easter parade, but people are in cars driving by other parishioners' houses, because part of Easter is community.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole nature of what we practice as a faith, and I would say really most, if not all, religions are rooted in community. We're just honestly trying to build community the best way we can. We've had some pretty creative ideas with some of the things we've done.
Well, I understand a virtual Easter egg hunt?
Yes. We have a really fun video on our Facebook page about this and some information on our website at tatesprings.com/Minecraft, because Minecraft is a really simple, safe video game. You just build stuff. And on our website, parents can sign up to join. On Easter Sunday after church, there'll be a little scavenger event there online that they can participate in, and just something kind of to break up the mundane nature of what everyone's experiencing right now.
Well, and Rabbi, we understand that, you know, so much about the Seder is the traditional foods, that recipes passed down, but people can prop up an iPad and cook together.
There are so many ways that we are creating community during this very different Passover. We say the famous line, why is this night different from all other nights? We're now saying, why is this Passover different from all other Passovers? What's amazing about Passover is the preparation in advance. This year, people need to think out what they are doing. They can't necessarily do the regular shopping that they do. We are more focused on what really matters, which are the values of Passover. Every single year at the Seder, we say in the ancient Aramaic, this year we are slaves. Next year we will be free. Mm-hmm. And this year we're not physically slaves, but we had to change everything that we are doing. And we know that if we pay attention to the things that matter, that is to protect life at all costs, to defeat this disease, and to worry about those who are at risk. That is the story of the Exodus, from oppression to freedom. Maybe the silver lining of this terrible crisis is that we are more sensitive to one another. Those are the most important Passover values. And frankly, they are the core values of all faiths.
Yeah, well, and also all of us get to feel what some populations are always feeling, fear, no ability to leave the house. And Pastor Wellman, it seems pretty obvious that the story of Easter is one that applies to this time, too. I mean, you can overcome. You can have rebirth.
Absolutely. And that's been the message that we've resounded every Sunday. The way we live, especially during trying times. So if we really believe what we've said we believe, which is that Jesus rose from the dead, he conquered the grave, that actually colors and informs and changes the way that we view everything. And we've kind of couched the coronavirus as this antagonism. you know, we're actually walking through Acts right now. And so Acts is about the birth of the church and how there was an antagonism. How do we live out our faith whenever we feel like we're being challenged? And the root of all that is our hope in the resurrection, which Paul says is the pinnacle of our faith.
We spoke to Bruce Feiler, the author. For those who are secular, we look at both of the stories. If you just accept them as parables, you know, you can escape the slavery. You can get to the other side. We look at nature all around us. I mean, we watch nature renew every spring.
I think this is a time when we need to pray for those who are on the front lines, and they should inspire us to embrace our traditions and commitments, but to do it in the safest way possible. And as the pastor and I both in our individual ways said, to focus on the values that are inherent in the messages of this season. Spring will come after this winter, and we are very hopeful that this season of holidays will be the touch point by which we'll be able to get to the other side.
You know, in times of darkness like this, many people become dark. You know, they hunker down. They suddenly their God becomes a punishing God. There's that silly joke that if somebody's saying, you know, God, why have you forsaken me? The answer might be, what are you talking about? I gave you all those nurses and doctors.
Absolutely. We are given the tools in order to be partners with God in creation and healing the world. I am certain of that.
Yeah. And that we're living in a time of really grace. It may not feel like it all the time, but we're living in a time of grace where he's giving us an opportunity to work out our faith, to mature in our faith.
Pastor Jared Wellman of Tate Springs Baptist Church there in Arlington, Texas, and also Rabbi Noam Marins at the American Jewish Committee. I want to thank you both so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Remember when President Trump said, we cannot let the cure be worse than the problem itself, meaning COVID-19. And he said he envisioned church pews filled by what would be the end of this week. Well, instead, the CDC is saying everyone should stay home and wear masks for the foreseeable future. And the Surgeon General is saying this Holy Week for many could also be the saddest week in many Americans' lives. One reason for the change in policy could be that researchers from MIT found that during the 1918 flu, the cities that shut down the most saw their economies come back the strongest. Dylan Matthews, a senior correspondent for Vox, has taken a closer look at the research. Hi, Dylan.
Hi, Robin.
And we should say these MIT researchers, Sergio Correa, Stephen Luck, and Emil Verner, used data from a 2000 paper in the Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, that crunched some stats from 1918 of what different cities did. So what were some of the things they did, the varying degrees of isolation?
A lot of the measures are quite similar to stuff that you hear about now during coronavirus, things like school closures, bans on big public gatherings, mandatory isolation and quarantine for people who've been diagnosed with coronavirus. So a lot of social distancing procedures before the term social distancing became a thing.
It was fascinating to read in your article that people were quarantined in their homes with an official placard declaring their location to be under quarantine. And the cities that did the most, in other words, did not just one or two of these things, but the most of them, you know, did them for health policies. But as you write, these health policies, in fact, became economic policies. How so?
Right. So the JAMA paper by doctors and public health researchers found a strong association between these policies and lower mortality. But what these economists have done is pair that data on what cities did with data we have now about what happened to the economies in these cities over time. So what happened to jobs at this point? We mostly had a manufacturing economy, so they particularly look at jobs in factories and manufacturing output in manufacturing plants, the share of the population that has jobs. And they found that just as areas with these policies had better health outcomes, they also had better economic outcomes. And at least some of this seems to be because it really hurts your economy to have a large pandemic crushing through your city.
Well, especially if people die, because as you write, these health policies of quarantining and social distancing saved lives. The cities that had fewer deaths had a healthier workforce on the other side. So fewer deaths equaled a better economy.
Exactly. And conversely, cities that got hit harder, and one of the things they find in this paper is that those were disproportionately cities on the East Coast, that in 1918 to 1919, the pandemic sort of went east to west. And so cities like San Francisco and Seattle had more time to get quarantining policies in place, and cities like Boston or New York City were harder hit. But ones that were harder hit saw nearly a 20% drop in manufacturing output months after the pandemic had passed.
Right. And as you say, the cities that were watching this happen had a better chance to put more isolation in place to try to stave off what they were seeing happen in other cities. You point out there are some flaws with this. For instance, we don't know. Maybe the cities that did better had other things that were better, too, including, you know, hospital infrastructures. But it really does seem, on the face of it, that, you know, the way to have a better economy after a pandemic is to have more pain during the pandemic and shut things down quicker and stave off the effects of the pandemic.
That's right. And one reaction some people have to the cure can't be worse than the disease rhetoric is to say, we don't exist for the economy. The economy exists for us. But I almost feel like you don't have to embrace that trade-off. And one thing this research shows us is that the economy is also made up of people. And when people are healthier, the economy is healthier.
Yeah. Again, this hasn't been peer-reviewed. This seemed pretty eyebrow-raising, and it feels as if, we don't know, but it feels as if it's having an impact on policies as they're made now. How's it, you know, going through economic circles?
For sure. I think one thing that's been remarkable to me is seeing the unity of economics as a profession right now in this crisis. There's just an enormous amount of consensus that what you need to do is keep people socially distant, contain the pandemic, save lives, and worry about getting the economy back to where it was before after the pandemic has passed.
Well, it also means, as you write, that we don't have to ask that terrible question, what's the value of a human life? You had Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick saying grandparents would happily die for the future economy of their grandchildren. I'm paraphrasing, but his point was, we don't have to shut everything down to protect our senior citizens. They don't want us to shut down the economy. Raising the question of what's the value of a grandparent's life, you say this research seems to indicate we don't have to ask those terrible questions. We know that shutting down the economy is better for those grandchildren after the pandemic is over.
Absolutely. One thing this paper suggests is that we might not have a hard trade-off here. This might be a win-win.
That's Dylan Matthews, senior correspondent for Vox. Dylan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Hope they're right. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.